Over the next 11 years, Einstein developed a new theory of gravity, which he called general relativity. The concept of gravity in general relativity is nothing like Newton's. Instead, it is based on the revolutionary proposal that space-time is not flat, as had been assumed previously, but is curved and distorted by the mass and energy in it. A good way to picture curvature is to think of the surface of the Earth. Although the Earth's surface is only two-dimensional, because there are only two directions along it, say north-south and east-west, we're going to use it as our example because a curved two-dimensional space is easier to picture than a curved four-dimensional space. The geometry of curved spaces, such as the Earth's surface, is not the Euclidean geometry we are familiar with. For example, on the Earth's surface, the shortest distance between two points, which we know as a line in Euclidean geometry, is the path connecting the two points along what is called a great circle. A great circle is a circle along the Earth's surface whose center coincides with the center of the Earth. The equator is an example of a great circle, and so is any circle obtained by rotating the equator along different diameters. Imagine, say, that you wanted to travel from New York to Madrid, two cities that are at almost the same latitude. If the Earth were flat, the shortest route would be to head straight east. If you did that, you would arrive in Madrid after traveling 3,707 miles. But due to the Earth's curvature, there is a path that on a flat map looks curved and hence longer, which is actually shorter. You can get there in 3,605 miles if you follow the Great Circle route, which is to first head northeast, then gradually turn east, and then southeast. The difference in distance between the two routes is due to the Earth's curvature and a sign of its non-Euclidean geometry. Airlines know this and arrange for their pilots to follow Great Circle routes whenever practical. According to Newton's laws of motion, objects such as cannonballs, croissants, and planets move in straight lines unless acted upon by a force, such as gravity. But gravity, in Einstein's theory, is not a force like other forces. Rather, it is a consequence of the fact that mass distorts space-time, creating curvature. In Einstein's theory, objects move on geodesics, which are the nearest things to straight lines in a curved space. Lines are geodesics on the flat plane, and great circles are geodesics on the surface of the Earth. In the absence of matter, the geodesics in four-dimensional space-time correspond to lines in three-dimensional space. But when matter is present, distorting space-time, the paths of bodies in the corresponding three-dimensional space curve in a manner that in Newtonian theory was explained by the attraction of gravity. When space-time is not flat, objects' paths appear to be bent, giving the impression that a force is acting on them. Einstein's general theory of relativity reproduces special relativity when gravity is absent, and it makes almost the same predictions as Newton's theory of gravity in the weak gravity environment of our solar system, but not quite. In fact, if general relativity were not taken into account in GPS satellite navigation systems, errors in global positions would accumulate at a rate of about 10 kilometers each day. However, the real importance of general relativity is not its application in devices that guide you to new restaurants, but rather that it is a very different model of the universe, which predicts new effects such as gravitational waves and black holes. And so general relativity has transformed physics into geometry. Modern technology is sensitive enough to allow us to perform many sensitive tests of general relativity, and it has passed every one. Though they both revolutionized physics, Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism and Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity, are both, like Newton's own physics, classical theories. That is, they are models in which the universe has a single history. As we saw in the last chapter, at the atomic and subatomic levels, these models do not agree with observations. Instead, we have to use quantum theories in which the universe can have any possible history, each with its own intensity or probability amplitude. For practical calculations involving the everyday world, we can continue to use classical theories. But if we wish to understand the behavior of atoms and molecules, we need a quantum version of Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism. And if we want to understand the early universe, when all the matter and energy in the universe were squeezed into a small volume, we must have a quantum version of the theory of general relativity. We also need such theories because, if we are seeking a fundamental understanding of nature, it would not be consistent if some of the laws were quantum while others were classical. We therefore have to find quantum versions of all the laws of nature. Such theories are called quantum field theories. The known forces of nature can be divided into four classes. 1. Gravity. This is the weakest of the four, but it is a long-range force and acts on everything in the universe as an attraction. This means that for large bodies, the gravitational forces all add up and can dominate over all other forces. 2. Electromagnetism. This is also long-range and is much stronger than gravity, but it acts only on particles with an electric charge, being repulsive between charges of the same sign and attractive between charges of the opposite sign. This means the electric forces between large bodies cancel each other out, but on the scales of atoms and molecules, they dominate. Electromagnetic forces are responsible for all of chemistry and biology. 3. Weak nuclear force. This causes radioactivity and plays a vital role in the formation of the elements in stars in the early universe. We don't, however, come into contact with this force in our everyday lives. 4. Strong nuclear force. This force holds together the protons and neutrons inside the nucleus of an atom. It also holds together the protons and neutrons themselves, which is necessary because they are made of still tinier particles, the quarks we mentioned in Chapter 3. The strong force is the energy source for the sun and nuclear power, but, as with the weak force, we don't have direct contact with it. The first force for which a quantum version was created was electromagnetism. The quantum theory of the electromagnetic field, called quantum electrodynamics, or QED for short, was developed in the 1940s by Richard Feynman and others, and has become a model for all quantum field theories. As we've said, according to classical theories, forces are transmitted by fields. But in quantum field theories, the force fields are pictured as being made of various elementary particles called bosons, which are force-carrying particles that fly back and forth between matter particles, transmitting the forces. The matter particles are called fermions. Electrons and quarks are examples of fermions. The photon, or particle of light, is an example of a boson. It is the boson that transmits the electromagnetic force. What happens is that a matter particle, such as an electron, emits a boson, or force particle, and recoils from it, much as a cannon recoils after firing a cannonball. The force particle then collides with another matter particle and is absorbed, changing the motion of that particle. According to QED, all the interactions between charged particles, particles that feel the electromagnetic force, are described in terms of the exchange of photons. The predictions of QED have been tested and found to match experimental results with great precision. But performing the mathematical calculations required by QED can be difficult. The problem, as we'll see below, is that when you add to the above framework of particle exchange, the quantum requirement that one include all the histories by which an interaction can occur, for example, all the ways the force particles can be exchanged, the mathematics becomes complicated. Fortunately, along with inventing the notion of alternative histories, the way of thinking about quantum theories described in the last chapter, Feynman also developed a neat graphical method of accounting for the different histories, a method that is today applied not just to quantum electrodynamics, but to all quantum field theories. Feynman's graphical method provides a way of visualizing each term in the sum over histories. Those pictures, called Feynman diagrams, are one of the most important tools of modern physics. In QED, the sum over all possible histories can be represented as a sum over Feynman diagrams, which represent some of the ways it is possible for two electrons to scatter off each other through the electromagnetic force. In the first diagram, the two electrons approach each other, exchange a photon, and then continue on their way. That is the simplest way in which two electrons can interact electromagnetically, but we must consider all possible histories. Feynman diagrams indicate only a few of the possibilities. In fact, there are an infinite number of diagrams which must be mathematically accounted for. Feynman diagrams aren't just a neat way of picturing and categorizing how interactions can occur. Feynman diagrams come with rules that allow you to read off, from the lines and vertices in each diagram, a mathematical expression. The probabilities say that the incoming electrons with some given initial momentum will end up flying off with some particular final momentum is then obtained by summing the contributions from each Feynman diagram. That can take some work, because, as we've said, there are an infinite number of them. Moreover, although the incoming and outgoing electrons are assigned a definite energy and momentum, the particles in the closed loops in the interior of the diagram can have any energy and momentum. That is important because in forming the Feynman sum, one must sum not only over all diagrams, but also over all those values of energy and momentum. Feynman diagrams provided physicists with enormous help in visualizing and calculating the probabilities of the processes described by QED, but they did not cure one important ailment suffered by the theory. When you add the contributions from the infinite number of different histories, you get an infinite result. If the successive terms in an infinite sum decrease fast enough, it is possible for the sum to be finite, but that, unfortunately, doesn't happen here. In particular, when the Feynman diagrams are added up, the answer seems to imply that the electron has an infinite mass and charge. This is absurd, because we can measure the mass and charge, and they are finite. To deal with these infinities, a procedure called renormalization was developed. The process of renormalization involves subtracting quantities that are defined to be infinite and negative in such a way that, with careful mathematical accounting, the sum of the negative infinite values and the positive infinite values that arise in the theory almost cancel out, leaving a small remainder, the finite observed values of mass and charge. These manipulations might sound like the sort of things that get you a flunking grade on a school math exam, and renormalization is indeed, as it sounds, mathematically dubious. One consequence is that the values obtained by this method for the mass and charge of the electron can be any finite number. That has the advantage that physicists may choose the negative infinities in a way that gives the right answer, but the disadvantage that the mass and charge of the electron, therefore, cannot be predicted from the theory. But once we have fixed the mass and charge of the electron in this manner, we can employ QED to make many other very precise predictions, which all agree extremely closely with observation. So renormalization is one of the essential ingredients of QED. An early triumph of QED, for example, was the correct prediction of the so-called Lamb shift, a small change in the energy of one of the states of the hydrogen atom discovered in 1947. The success of renormalization in quantum electrodynamics encouraged attempts to look for quantum field theories describing the other three forces of nature. But the division of natural forces into four classes is probably artificial and a consequence of our lack of understanding. People have therefore sought a theory of everything that will unify the four classes into a single law that is compatible with quantum theory. This would be the holy grail of physics. One indication that unification is the right approach came from the theory of the weak force. The quantum field theory describing the weak force on its own cannot be renormalized. That is, it has infinities that cannot be cancelled by subtracting a finite number of quantities, such as mass and charge. However, in 1967, Abdus Salam and Steven Weinberg each independently proposed a theory in which electromagnetism was unified with the weak force and found that the unification cured the plague of infinities. The unified force is called the electroweak force. Its theory could be renormalized, and it predicted three new particles called W+, W- and Z0. Evidence for the Z0 was discovered at CERN in Geneva in 1973. Salam and Weinberg were awarded the Nobel Prize in 1979, although the W and Z particles were not observed directly until 1983. The strong force can be renormalized on its own in a theory called QCD, or quantum chromodynamics. According to QCD, the proton, the neutron, and many other elementary particles of matter are made of quarks, which have a remarkable property that physicists have come to call color, hence the term chromodynamics, although quark colors are just helpful labels, there is no connection with visible color. Quarks come in three so-called colors, red, green, and blue. In addition, each quark has an antiparticle partner, and the colors of those particles are called anti-red, anti-green, and anti-blue. The idea is that only combinations with no net color can exist as free particles. There are two ways to achieve such neutral quark combinations. A color and its anti-color cancel, so a quark and an anti-quark form a colorless pair, an unstable particle called a meson. Also, when all the three colors or anti-colors are mixed, the result has no net color. Three quarks, one of each color, form stable particles called baryons, of which protons and neutrons are examples, and three antiquarks form the antiparticles of the baryons. Protons and neutrons are the baryons that make up the nucleus of atoms and are the basis for all normal matter in the universe. QCD also has a property called asymptotic freedom, which we referred to without naming it in Chapter 3. Asymptotic freedom means that the strong forces between quarks are small when the quarks are close together, but increase if they are farther apart, rather as though they were joined by rubber bands. Asymptotic freedom explains why we don't see isolated quarks in nature and have been unable to produce them in the laboratory. Still, even though we cannot observe individual quarks, we accept the model because it works so well at explaining the behavior of protons, neutrons, and other particles of matter. After uniting the weak and electromagnetic forces, physicists in the 1970s looked for a way to bring the strong force into that theory. There are a number of so-called grand unified theories, or GUTs, that unify the strong forces with the weak force and electromagnetism. But they mostly predict that protons, the stuff that we are made of, should decay, on average, after about 10 to the 32nd power years. That is a very long lifetime, given that the universe is only about 10 to the 10th power years old. But in quantum physics, when we say the average lifetime of a particle is 10 to the 32nd power years, we don't mean that most particles live approximately that long, some a bit more and some a bit less. Instead, what we mean is that each year, the particle has a 1 in 10 to the 32nd power chance of decaying. As a result, if you watch a tank containing 10 to the 32nd power protons for just a few years, you ought to see some of the protons decay. It is not too hard to build such a tank, since that many protons are contained in just 1,000 tons of water. Scientists have performed such experiments. It turns out that detecting the decays and differentiating them from other events caused by the cosmic rays that continually shower us from space is no easy matter. To minimize the noise, the experiments are carried out deep inside places such as the Kamioka Mining and Smelting Company's mine, 3,281 feet under a mountain in Japan, which is somewhat shielded from cosmic rays. As a result of observations in 2009, researchers have concluded that if protons decay at all, The proton lifetime is greater than about 10 to the 34th power years, which is bad news for grand unified theories. Since earlier observational evidence had also failed to support GUTs, most physicists adopted an ad hoc theory called the Standard Model, which comprises the unified theory of the electroweak forces and QCD as a theory of the strong forces. But in the Standard Model, the electroweak and strong forces act separately and are not truly unified. The Standard Model is very successful and agrees with all current observational evidence, but it is ultimately unsatisfactory because, apart from not unifying the electroweak and strong forces, it does not include gravity. It may have proved difficult to meld the strong force with the electromagnetic and weak forces, but those problems are nothing compared with the problem of merging gravity with the other three, or even of creating a standalone quantum theory of gravity. The reason a quantum theory of gravity has proven so hard to create has to do with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which we discussed in Chapter 4. It is not obvious, but it turns out that with regard to that principle, the value of a field and its rate of change play the same role as the position and velocity of a particle. That is, the more accurately one is determined, the less accurately the other can be. An important consequence of that is that there is no such thing as empty space. That is because empty space means that both the value of a field and its rate of change are exactly zero. If the field's rate of change were not zero, the space would not remain empty. Since the uncertainty principle does not allow the values of both the field and the rate of change to be exact, space is never empty. It can have a state of minimum energy called the vacuum, but that state is subject to what are called quantum jitters, or vacuum fluctuations, particles and fields quivering in and out of existence. One can think of the vacuum fluctuations as pairs of particles that appear together at some time, move apart, then come together and annihilate each other. In terms of Feynman diagrams, they correspond to closed loops. These particles are called virtual particles. Unlike real particles, virtual particles cannot be observed directly with a particle detector. However, their indirect effects, such as small changes in the energy of electron orbits, can be measured, and agree with theoretical predictions to a remarkable degree of accuracy. The problem is that the virtual particles have energy, and because there are an infinite number of virtual pairs, they would have an infinite amount of energy. According to general relativity, this means that they would curve the universe to an infinitely small size, which obviously does not happen. This plague of infinities is similar to the problem that occurs in the theories of the strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces, except in those cases renormalization removes the infinities. But the closed loops in the Feynman diagrams for gravity produce infinities that cannot be absorbed by renormalization, because in general relativity there are not enough renormalizable parameters, such as the values of mass and change, to remove all the quantum infinities from the theory. We are therefore left with a theory of gravity that predicts that certain quantities, such as the curvature of space-time, are infinite, which is no way to run a habitable universe. That means the only possibility of obtaining a sensible theory would be for all the infinities to somehow cancel, without resorting to renormalization. In 1976, a possible solution to that problem was found. It is called supergravity. The prefix super was not appended because physicists thought it was super that this theory of quantum gravity might actually work. Instead, super refers to a kind of symmetry the theory possesses, called supersymmetry. In physics, a system is said to have symmetry if its properties are unaffected by a certain transformation, such as rotating it in space or taking its mirror image. For example, if you flip a donut over, it looks exactly the same, unless it has a chocolate topping, in which case it is better just to eat it. Supersymmetry is a more subtle kind of symmetry that cannot be associated with a transformation of ordinary space. One of the important implications of supersymmetry is that force particles and matter particles, and hence force and matter, are really just two facets of the same thing. Practically speaking, that means that each matter particle, such as a quark, ought to have a partner particle that is a force particle, and each force particle, such as the photon, ought to have a partner particle that is a matter particle. This has the potential to solve the problem of infinities, because it turns out that the infinities from closed loops of force particles are positive, while the infinities from closed loops of matter particles are negative. So the infinities in the theory arising from the force particles and their partner matter particles tend to cancel out. Unfortunately, the calculations required to find out whether there would be any infinities left uncancelled in supergravity were so long and difficult and had such potential for error that no one was prepared to undertake them. Most physicists believed, nonetheless, that supergravity was probably the right answer to the problem of unifying gravity with the other forces. You might think that the validity of supersymmetry would be an easy thing to check, just examine the properties of the existing particles and see if they pair up. No such partner particles have been observed. But various calculations that physicists have performed indicate that the partner particles corresponding to the particles we observe ought to be 1,000 times as massive as a proton, if not even heavier. That is too heavy for such particles to have been seen in any experiments to date. But there is hope that such particles will eventually be created in the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. The idea of supersymmetry was the key to the creation of supergravity, but the concept had actually originated years earlier, with theorists studying a fledgling theory called string theory. According to string theory, particles are not points, but patterns of vibration that have length but no height or width, like infinitely thin pieces of string. String theories also lead to infinities, but it is believed that in the right version they will all cancel out. They have another unusual feature. They are consistent only if space-time has 10 dimensions instead of the usual 4. 10 dimensions might sound exciting, but they would cause real problems if you forgot where you parked your car. If they are present, why don't we notice these extra dimensions? According to string theory, they are curved up into a space of very small size. To picture this, imagine a two-dimensional plane. We call the plane two-dimensional because you need two numbers, for instance, horizontal and vertical coordinates, to locate any point on it. Another two-dimensional space is the surface of a straw. To locate a point on that space, you need to know where along the straw's length the point is, and also where along its circular dimension. But if the straw is very thin, you would get a very good approximate position employing only the coordinate that runs along the straw's length, so you might ignore the circular dimension. And if the straw were a million, 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 millionth of an inch in diameter, you wouldn't notice the circular dimension at all. That is the picture string theorists have of the extra dimensions. They are highly curved, or curled, on a scale so small that we don't see them. In string theory, the extra dimensions are curled up into what is called the internal space, as opposed to the three-dimensional space that we experience in everyday life. As we'll see, these internal states are not just hidden dimensions swept under the rug. They have important physical significance. In addition to the question of dimensions, string theory suffered from another awkward issue. There appeared to be at least 5 different theories, and millions of ways the extra dimensions could be curled up, which was quite an embarrassment of possibilities for those advocating that string theory was the unique theory of everything. Then, around 1994, people started to discover dualities, that different string theories and different ways of curling up the extra dimensions are simply different ways of describing the same phenomena in 4 dimensions. Moreover, they found that supergravity is also related to the other theories in this way. String theorists are now convinced that the 5 different string theories and supergravity are just different approximations to a more fundamental theory, each valid in different situations. That more fundamental theory is called M theory, as we mentioned earlier. No one seems to know what the M stands for, but it may be master, miracle, or mystery. It seems to be all three. People are still trying to decipher the nature of M theory, but that may not be possible. It could be that the physicists' traditional expectation of a single theory of nature is untenable, and there exists no single formulation. It might be that to describe the universe, we have to employ different theories in different situations. Each theory may have its own version of reality, but according to model-dependent realism, that is acceptable so long as the theories agree in their predictions whenever they overlap, that is, whenever they can both be applied. Whether M theory exists as a single formulation or only as a network, we do know some of its properties. First, M theory has 11 space-time dimensions, not 10. String theorists had long suspected that the prediction of 10 dimensions might have to be adjusted, and recent work showed that one dimension had indeed been overlooked. Also, M theory can contain not just vibrating strings, but also point particles, two-dimensional membranes, three-dimensional blobs, and other objects that are more difficult to picture and occupy even more dimensions of space, up to 9. These objects are called P-brains, where P runs from 0 to 9. What about the enormous number of ways to curl up the tiny dimensions? In M theory, those extra space dimensions cannot be curled up in just any way. The mathematics of the theory restricts the manner in which the dimensions of the internal space can be curled. The exact shape of the internal space determines both the values of physical constants, such as the charge of the electron, and the nature of the interactions between elementary particles. In other words, it determines the apparent laws of nature. We say apparent because we mean the laws that we observe in our universe, the laws of the four forces, and the parameters such as mass and charge that characterize the elementary particles. But the more fundamental laws are those of M theory. The laws of M theory, therefore, allow for different universes with different apparent laws, depending on how the internal space is curled. M theory has solutions that allow for many different internal spaces, perhaps as many as 10 to the 500th power, which means it allows for 10 to the 500th power different universes, each with its own laws. To get an idea how many that is, think about this. If some being could analyze the laws predicted for each of those universes in just 1 millisecond and had started working on it at the Big Bang, at present that being would have studied just 10 to the 20th power of them. And that's without coffee breaks. Centuries ago, Newton showed that mathematical equations could provide a startlingly accurate description of the way objects interact, both on Earth and in the heavens. Scientists were led to believe that the future of the entire universe could be laid out if only we knew the proper theory and had enough computing power. Then came quantum uncertainty, curved space, quarks, strings, and extra dimensions, and the net result of their labor is 10 to the 500th power universes, each with different laws, only one of which corresponds to the universe as we know it. The original hope of physicists to produce a single theory explaining the apparent laws of our universe as the unique possible consequence of a few simple assumptions may have to be abandoned. Where does that leave us? If M theory allows for 10 to the 500th power sets of apparent laws, how did we end up in this universe with the laws that are apparent to us? And what about those other possible worlds? Chapter 6: Choosing Our Universe. According to the Bushongo people of Central Africa, in the beginning there was only darkness, water, and the great god Bumba. One day Bumba, in pain from a stomachache, vomited up the sun. In time, the sun dried up some of the water, leaving land. But Bumba was still in pain and vomited some more. Up came the moon, the stars, and then some animals, the leopard, the crocodile, the turtle, and finally man. The Mayans of Mexico and Central America tell of a similar time before creation when all that existed were the sea, the sky, and the Maker. In the Mayan legend, the Maker, unhappy because there was no one to praise him, created the earth, mountains, trees, and most animals. But the animals could not speak, and so he decided to create humans. First, he made them of mud and earth, but they only spoke nonsense. He let them dissolve away and tried again, this time fashioning people from wood. Those people were dull. He decided to destroy them, but they escaped into the forest, sustaining damage along the way that altered them slightly, creating what we today know as monkeys. After that fiasco, the Maker finally came upon a formula that worked and constructed the first humans from white and yellow corn. Today we make ethanol from corn, but so far haven't matched the Maker's feat of constructing the people who drink it. Creation myths like these all attempt to answer the questions we address in this book. Why is there a universe? And why is the universe the way it is? Our ability to address such questions has grown steadily in the centuries since the ancient Greeks, most profoundly over the past century. Armed with the background of the previous chapters, we are now ready to offer a possible answer to these questions. One thing that may have been apparent even in early times was that either the universe was a very recent creation, or else human beings have existed for only a small fraction of cosmic history. That's because the human race has been improving so rapidly in knowledge and technology that if people had been around for millions of years, the human race would be much further along in its mastery. According to the Old Testament, God created Adam and Eve only 6 days into creation. Bishop Usher, Primate of All Ireland from 1625 to 1656, placed the origin of the world even more precisely at 9 in the morning on October 27th, 4004 BC. We take a different view, that humans are a recent creation, but that the universe itself began much earlier, about 13.7 billion years ago. The first actual scientific evidence that the universe had a beginning came in the 1920s. As we said in Chapter 3, that was a time when most scientists believed in a static universe that had always existed. The evidence to the contrary was indirect, based upon the observations Edwin Hubble made with the 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson in the hills above Pasadena, California. By analyzing the spectrum of light they emit, Hubble determined that nearly all galaxies are moving away from us, and the farther away they are, the faster they are moving. In 1929, he published a law relating their rate of recession to their distance from us and concluded that the universe is expanding. If that is true, then the universe must have been smaller in the past. In fact, if we extrapolate to the distant past, all the matter and energy in the universe would have been concentrated in a very tiny region of unimaginable density and temperature. And if we go back far enough, there would be a time when it all began, the event we now call the Big Bang. The idea that the universe is expanding involves a bit of subtlety. For example, we don't mean the universe is expanding in the manner that, say, one might expand one's house by knocking out a wall and positioning a new bathroom where once there stood a majestic oak. Rather than space extending itself, it is the distance between any two points within the universe that is growing. That idea emerged in the 1930s amid much controversy, but one of the best ways to visualize it is still a metaphor enunciated in 1931 by Cambridge University astronomer Arthur Eddington. Eddington visualized the universe as the surface of an expanding balloon, and all the galaxies as points on that surface. This picture clearly illustrates why far galaxies recede more quickly than nearby ones. For example, if the radius of the balloon doubled each hour, then the distance between any two galaxies on the balloon would double each hour. If at some time two galaxies were 1 inch apart, an hour later they would be 2 inches apart, and they would appear to be moving relative to each other at a rate of 1 inch per hour. But if they started 2 inches apart, An hour later, they would be separated by 4 inches and would appear to be moving away from each other at a rate of 2 inches per hour. That is just what Hubble found. The farther away a galaxy, the faster it was moving away from us. It is important to realize that the expansion of space does not affect the size of material objects such as galaxies, stars, apples, atoms, or other objects held together by some sort of force. For example, if we circled a cluster of galaxies on the balloon, that circle would not expand as the balloon expanded. Rather, because the galaxies are bound by gravitational forces, the circle and the galaxies within it would keep their size and configuration as the balloon enlarged. This is important because we can detect expansion only if our measuring instruments have fixed sizes. If everything were free to expand, then we, our yardsticks, our laboratories, and so on would all expand proportionately, and we would not notice any difference. That the universe is expanding was news to Einstein. But the possibility that the galaxies are moving away from each other had been proposed a few years before Hubble's papers on theoretical grounds arising from Einstein's own equations. In 1922, Russian physicist and mathematician Alexander Friedman investigated what would happen in a model universe based upon 2 assumptions that greatly simplified the mathematics: that the universe looks identical in every direction, and that it looks that way from every observation point. We know that Friedman's first assumption is not exactly true. The universe, fortunately, is not uniform everywhere. If we gaze upward in one direction, we might see the sun, in another, the moon, or a colony of migrating vampire bats. But the universe does appear to be roughly the same in every direction when viewed on a scale that is far larger, larger even than the distance between galaxies. It is something like looking down at a forest. If you are close enough, you can make out individual leaves, or at least trees, and the spaces between them. But if you are so high up that if you hold out your thumb it covers a square mile of trees, the forest will appear to be a uniform shade of green. We would say that, on that scale, the forest is uniform. Based on his assumptions, Friedman was able to discover a solution to Einstein's equations, in which the universe expanded in the manner that Hubble would soon discover to be true. In particular, Friedman's model universe begins with 0 size and expands until gravitational attraction slows it down and eventually causes it to collapse in upon itself. There are, it turns out, 2 other types of solutions to Einstein's equations that also satisfy the assumptions of Friedman's model: one corresponding to a universe in which the expansion continues forever, though it does slow a bit, and another to a universe in which the rate of expansion slows towards 0, but never quite reaches it. Friedman died a few years after producing this work, and his ideas remained largely unknown until after Hubble's discovery. But in 1927, a professor of physics and Roman Catholic priest named Georges Lemaître proposed a similar idea. If you trace the history of the universe backward into the past, it gets tinier and tinier until you come upon a creation event, what we now call the Big Bang. Not everyone liked the Big Bang picture. In fact, the term Big Bang was coined in 1949 by Cambridge astrophysicist Fred Hoyle, who believed in a universe that expanded forever and meant the term as a derisive description. The first direct observations supporting the idea didn't come until 1965, with the discovery that there is a faint background of microwaves throughout space. This cosmic microwave background radiation, or CMBR, is the same as that in your microwave oven, but much less powerful. You can observe the CMBR yourself by tuning your television to an unused channel. A few percent of the snow you see on the screen will be caused by it. The radiation was discovered by accident by 2 Bell Labs scientists trying to eliminate such static from their microwave antenna. At first, they thought the static might be coming from the droppings of pigeons roosting in their apparatus, but it turned out their problem had a more interesting origin. The CMBR is radiation left over from the very hot and dense early universe that would have existed shortly after the Big Bang. As the universe expanded, it cooled until the radiation became just the faint remnant we now observe. At present, these microwaves could heat your food to only about minus 270 degrees centigrade, 3 degrees above absolute zero, and not very useful for popping corn. Astronomers have also found other fingerprints supporting the Big Bang picture of a hot, tiny, early universe. For example, during the first minute or so, the universe would have been hotter than the center of a typical star. During that period, the entire universe would have acted as a nuclear fusion reactor. The reactions would have ceased when the universe expanded and cooled sufficiently, but the theory predicts that this should have left a universe composed mainly of hydrogen, but also about 23% helium and traces of lithium. All heavier elements were made later inside stars. The calculation is in good accordance with the amounts of helium, lithium, and beryllium we observe. Measurements of helium abundance and the cosmic microwave background radiation provided convincing evidence in favor of the Big Bang picture of the very early universe. But although one can think of the Big Bang picture as a valid description of early times, it is wrong to take the Big Bang literally, that is, to think of Einstein's theory as providing a true picture of the origin of the universe. That is because general relativity predicts there to be a point in time at which the temperature, density, and curvature of the universe are all infinite, a situation mathematicians call a singularity. To a physicist, this means that Einstein's theory breaks down at that point, and therefore cannot be used to predict how the universe began, only how it evolved afterward. So although we can employ the equations of general relativity and our observations of the heavens to learn about the universe at a very young age, it is not correct to carry the Big Bang picture all the way back to the beginning. We will get to the issue of the origin of the universe shortly, but first a few words about the first phase of the expansion. Physicists call it inflation. Unless you've lived in Zimbabwe, where currency inflation recently exceeded 200 million%, the term may not sound very explosive. But according to even conservative estimates, during this cosmological inflation, the universe expanded by a factor of 1, followed by 30 zeros, during a period of 34 zeros, followed by a 1 second. It was as if a coin 1 centimeter in diameter suddenly blew up to 10 million times the width of the Milky Way. That may seem to violate relativity, which dictates that nothing can move faster than light, but that speed limit does not apply to the expansion of space itself. The idea that such an episode of inflation might have occurred was first proposed in 1980. Based on considerations that go beyond Einstein's theory of general relativity and take into account aspects of quantum theory. Since we don't have a complete quantum theory of gravity, the details are still being worked out, and physicists aren't sure exactly how inflation happened. But according to the theory, the expansion caused by inflation would not be completely uniform, as predicted by the traditional Big Bang picture. These irregularities would produce minuscule variations in the temperature of the CMBR in different directions. The variations are too small to have been observed in the 1960s, but they were first discovered in 1992 by NASA's COBE satellite, and later measured by its successor, the WMAP satellite, launched in 2001. As a result, we are now confident that inflation really did happen. Ironically, though tiny variations in the CMBR are evidence for inflation, one reason inflation is an important concept is the nearly perfect uniformity of the temperature of the CMBR. If you make one part of an object hotter than its surroundings and then wait, the hotspot will grow cooler and its surroundings warmer until the temperature of the object is uniform. Similarly, one would expect the universe to eventually have a uniform temperature. But this process takes time, and if inflation hadn't occurred, there wouldn't have been enough time in the history of the universe for heat at widely separated regions to equalize, assuming that the speed of such heat transfer is limited by the speed of light. A period of very rapid expansion, much faster than light speed, remedies that, because there would have been enough time for the equalization to happen in the extremely tiny pre-inflationary early universe. Inflation explains the bang in the Big Bang, at least in the sense that the expansion it represents was far more extreme than the expansion predicted by the traditional Big Bang theory of general relativity during the time interval in which inflation occurred. The problem is, for our theoretical models of inflation to work, the initial state of the universe had to be set up in a very special and highly improbable way. Thus, traditional inflation theory resolves one set of issues but creates another: the need for a very special initial state. That time zero issue is eliminated in the theory of the creation of the universe we are about to describe. Since we cannot describe creation employing Einstein's theory of general relativity, if we want to describe the origin of the universe, general relativity has to be replaced by a more complete theory. One would expect to need a more complete theory even if general relativity did not break down, because general relativity does not take into account the small-scale structure of matter, which is governed by quantum theory. We mentioned in Chapter 4 that for most practical purposes, quantum theory does not hold much relevance for the study of the large-scale structure of the universe, because quantum theory applies to the description of nature on microscopic scales. But if you go far enough back in time, the universe was as small as the Planck size, a billion trillion trillionth of a centimeter, which is the scale at which quantum theory does have to be taken into account. So though we don't yet have a complete quantum theory of gravity, we do know that the origin of the universe was a quantum event. As a result, just as we combined quantum theory and general relativity, at least provisionally, to derive the theory of inflation, if we want to go back even further and understand the origin of the universe, we must combine what we know about general relativity with quantum theory. To see how this works, we need to understand the principle that gravity warps space and time. Warpage of space is easier to visualize than warpage of time. Imagine that the universe is the surface of a flat billiard table. The table's surface is a flat space, at least in two dimensions. If you roll a ball on the table, it will travel in a straight line. But if the table becomes warped or dented in places, then the ball will curve. It is easy to picture how the billiard table is warped in this example because it is curving into an outside third dimension. Since we can't step outside our own space-time to view its warpage, the space-time warpage in our universe is harder to imagine. But curvature can be detected even if you cannot step out and view it from the perspective of a larger space. It can be detected from within the space itself. Imagine a micro-ant confined to the surface of the table. Even without the ability to leave the table, the ant could detect a warp or dent by carefully charting distances. For example, the distance around a circle in flat space is always a bit more than 3 times the distance across its diameter. The actual multiple is pi. But if the ant cut across a circle encompassing the dent in the table in this example, it would find that the distance across is greater than expected, greater than 1/3 the distance around it. In fact, if the dent were deep enough, the ant would find that the distance around the circle is shorter than the distance across it. The same is true of warpage in our universe. It stretches or compresses the distance between points of space, changing its geometry or shape in a way that is measurable from within the universe. Warpage of time stretches or compresses time intervals in an analogous manner. Armed with these ideas, let's return to the issue of the beginning of the universe. We can speak separately of space and time, as we have in this discussion, in situations involving low speeds and weak gravity. In general, however, time and space can become intertwined, and so their stretching and compressing also involve a certain amount of mixing. This mixing is important in the early universe and the key to understanding the beginning of time. The issue of the beginning of time is a bit like the issue of the edge of the world. When people thought the world was flat, one might have wondered whether the sea poured over its edge. This has been tested experimentally. One can go around the world and not fall off. The problem of what happens at the edge of the world was solved when people realized that the world was not a flat plate, but a curved surface. Time, however, seemed to be like a model railway track. If it had a beginning, there would have to have been someone, i.e. God, to set the trains going. Although Einstein's general theory of relativity unified time and space as space-time and involved a certain mixing of space and time, time was still different from space and either had a beginning and an end or else went on forever. However, once we add the effects of quantum theory to the theory of relativity, in extreme cases, warpage can occur to such a great extent that time behaves like another dimension of space. In the early universe, when the universe was small enough to be governed by both general relativity and quantum theory, there were effectively four dimensions of space and none of time. That means that when we speak of the beginning of the universe, we are skirting the subtle issue that as we look backward toward the very early universe, time as we know it does not exist. We must accept that our usual ideas of space and time do not apply to the very early universe. That is beyond our experience, but not beyond our imagination or our mathematics. If in the early universe all four dimensions behave like space, what happens to the beginning of time? The realization that time can behave like another direction of space means one can get rid of the problem of time having a beginning, in a similar way in which we got rid of the edge of the world. Suppose the beginning of the universe was like the South Pole of the Earth, with degrees of latitude playing the role of time. As one moves north, the circles of constant latitude, representing the size of the universe, would expand. The universe would start as a point at the South Pole, but the South Pole is much like any other point. To ask what happened before the beginning of the universe would become a meaningless question, because there is nothing south of the South Pole. In this picture, space-time has no boundary. The same laws of nature hold at the South Pole as in other places. In an analogous manner, when one combines the general theory of relativity with quantum theory, the question of what happened before the beginning of the universe is rendered meaningless. This idea that histories should be closed surfaces without boundary is called the no-boundary condition. Over the centuries, many, including Aristotle, believed that the universe must have always existed in order to avoid the issue of how it was set up. Others believed the universe had a beginning and used it as an argument for the existence of God. The realization that time behaves like space presents a new alternative. It removes the age-old objection to the universe having a beginning, but also means that the beginning of the universe was governed by the laws of science and doesn't need to be set in motion by some god. If the origin of the universe was a quantum event, it should be accurately described by the Feynman sum over histories. To apply quantum theory to the entire universe, where the observers are part of the system being observed, is tricky, however. In Chapter 4, we saw how particles of matter fired at a screen with two slits in it could exhibit interference patterns just as water waves do. Feynman showed that this arises because a particle does not have a unique history. That is, as it moves from its starting point A to some end point B, it doesn't take one definite path, but rather simultaneously takes every possible path connecting the two points. From this point of view, interference is no surprise because, for instance, the particle can travel through both slits at the same time and interfere with itself. Applied to the motion of a particle, Feynman's method tells us that to calculate the probability of any particular endpoint, we need to consider all the possible histories that the particle might follow from its starting point to that end point. One can also use Feynman's methods to calculate the quantum probabilities for observations of the universe. If they are applied to the universe as a whole, there is no point A. So we add up all the histories that satisfy the no boundary condition and end at the universe we observe today. In this view, the universe appeared spontaneously, starting off in every possible way. Most of these correspond to other universes. While some of those universes are similar to ours, most are very different. They aren't just different in details, such as whether Elvis really did die young or whether turnips are a dessert food, but rather they differ even in their apparent laws of nature. In fact, many universes exist with many different sets of physical laws. Some people make a great mystery of this idea, sometimes called the multiverse concept, but these are just different expressions of the Feynman sum over histories. To picture this, let's alter Eddington's balloon analogy and instead think of the expanding universe as the surface of a bubble. Our picture of the spontaneous quantum creation of the universe is then a bit like the formation of bubbles of steam in boiling water. Many tiny bubbles appear and then disappear again. These represent mini-universes that expand but collapse again while still of microscopic size. They represent possible alternative universes, but they are not of much interest since they do not last long enough to develop galaxies and stars, let alone intelligent life. A few of the little bubbles, however, will grow large enough so that they will be safe from recollapse. They will continue to expand at an ever-increasing rate and will form the bubbles of steam we are able to see. These correspond to universes that start off expanding at an ever-increasing rate, in other words, universes in a state of inflation. As we said, the expansion caused by inflation would not be completely uniform. In the sum over histories, there is only one completely uniform and regular history, and it will have the greatest probability, but many other histories that are very slightly irregular will have probabilities that are almost as high. That is why inflation predicts that the early universe is likely to be slightly non-uniform, corresponding to the small variations in the intensity that were observed in the CMBR. The irregularities in the early universe are lucky for us. Why? Homogeneity is good if you don't want cream separating out from your milk, but a uniform universe is a boring universe. The irregularities in the early universe are important because if some regions had a slightly higher density than others, the gravitational attraction of the extra density would slow the expansion of that region compared with its surroundings. As the force of gravity slowly draws matter together, it can eventually cause it to collapse, to form galaxies and stars, which can lead to planets and, on at least one occasion, people. The WMAP picture of the microwave sky is the blueprint for all the structure in the universe. We are the product of quantum fluctuations in the very early universe. If one were religious, one could say that God really does play dice. This idea leads to a view of the universe that is profoundly different from the traditional concept, requiring us to adjust the way that we think about the history of the universe. In order to make predictions in cosmology, we need to calculate the probabilities of different states of the entire universe at the present time. In physics, one normally assumes some initial state for a system and evolves it forward in time, employing the relevant mathematical equations. Given the state of a system at one time, one tries to calculate the probability that the system will be in some different state at a later time. The usual assumption in cosmology is that the universe has a single definite history. One can use the laws of physics to calculate how this history develops with time. We call this the bottom-up approach to cosmology. But since we must take into account the quantum nature of the universe, as expressed by the Feynman sum over histories, the probability amplitude that the universe is now in a particular state is arrived at by adding up the contributions from all the histories that satisfy the no boundary condition and end in the state in question. In cosmology, in other words, one shouldn't follow the history of the universe from the bottom up, because that assumes there's a single history with a well-defined starting point and evolution. Instead, one should trace the histories from the top down, backward from the present time. Some histories will be more probable than others, and the sum will normally be dominated by a single history that starts with the creation of the universe and culminates in the state under consideration. But there will be different histories for different possible states of the universe at the present time. This leads to a radically different view of cosmology and the relation between cause and effect. The histories that contribute to the Feynman sum don't have an independent existence, but depend on what is being measured. We create history by our observation, rather than history creating us. The idea that the universe does not have a unique observer-independent history might seem to conflict with certain facts we know. There might be one history in which the moon is made of Roquefort cheese, but we have observed that the moon is not made of cheese, which is bad news for mice. Hence, histories in which the moon is made of cheese do not contribute to the present state of our universe, though they might contribute to others. That might sound like science fiction, but it isn't. An important implication of the top-down approach is that the apparent laws of nature depend on the history of the universe. Many scientists believe there exists a single theory that explains those laws as well as nature's physical constants, such as the mass of the electron or the dimensionality of space-time. But top-down cosmology dictates that the apparent laws of nature are different for different histories. Consider the apparent dimension of the universe. According to M-theory, space-time has 10 space dimensions and one time dimension. The idea is that 7 of the space dimensions are curled up so small that we don't notice them, leaving us with the illusion that all that exist are the 3 remaining large dimensions we are familiar with. One of the central open questions in M-theory is, why, in our universe, aren't there more large dimensions, and why are any dimensions curled up? Many people would like to believe that there is some mechanism that causes all but 3 of the space dimensions to curl up spontaneously. Alternatively, maybe all dimensions started small, but for some understandable reason, 3 space dimensions expanded and the rest did not. It seems, however, that there is no dynamical reason for the universe to appear 4-dimensional. Instead, top-down cosmology predicts that the number of large space dimensions is not fixed by any principle of physics. There will be a quantum probability amplitude for every number of large space dimensions from 0 to 10. The Feynman sum allows for all of these, for every possible history for the universe, but the observation that our universe has 3 large space dimensions selects out the subclass of histories that have the property that is being observed. In other words, the quantum probability that the universe has more or less than 3 large space dimensions is irrelevant, because we have already determined that we are in a universe with 3 large space dimensions. So as long as the probability amplitude for 3 large space dimensions is not exactly 0, it doesn't matter how small it is compared with the probability amplitude for other numbers of dimensions. It would be like asking for the probability amplitude that the present Pope is Chinese. We know that he is German, even though the probability that he is Chinese is higher because there are more Chinese than there are Germans. Similarly, we know our universe exhibits 3 large space dimensions, and so even though other numbers of large space dimensions may have a greater probability amplitude, we are interested only in histories with 3. What about the curled-up dimensions? Recall that in M-theory, the precise shape of the remaining curled-up dimensions, the internal space, determines both the values of physical quantities, such as the charge on the electron and the nature of the interactions between elementary particles, that is, the forces of nature. Things would have worked out neatly if M-theory had allowed just one shape for the curled dimensions, or perhaps a few, all but one of which might have been ruled out by some means, leaving us with just one possibility for the apparent laws of nature. Instead, there are probability amplitudes for perhaps as many as 10 to the 500th power different internal spaces, each leading to different laws and values for the physical constants.